Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well. I want to actually talk today about an issue that was raised. Frank Bruni in the Times raised an issue in his blog about service, and he got some service that he wasn't as happy with, and he points to a pattern, and he conjectures as to why, and I think it's an interesting conjecture. He talks about in the Diner's Journal, he visited Walter Foods in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Now, Williamsburg is sort of the trendy food capital of Brooklyn. And, 10 years ago, the New York Times restaurant critic wouldn't be talking about places in Brooklyn at all.
Wouldn't even mention it.
And now there are a lot of good restaurants.
And now occasionally they're reviewing restaurants in Brooklyn, which I thought was interesting.
So on this trendy corner, he talks about Walter Foods, and he says, it was interesting, and there was some stuff he liked and some stuff he didn't. But here's the paragraph I want to discuss with you, Mark. He said, service was curious, too. At Walter Foods, I noticed something I've seen more and more over recent recessionary months. Not enough servers working the dining room. To save on money, are restaurant managers erring on the side of too few people during a given shift rather than too many, so that no one's being paid just to stand around? And then he goes on and he talks about the service not being up to snuff, but he talks about the whole menu.
I think he might be misattributing that. And obviously we know a lot of restaurant managers and we're pretty intimately acquainted with this side of the equation. And I think that he's missed it just a little bit there. I do think that people are staffing their restaurants with fewer people. And maybe not enough to staff the dining room sometimes. I'm definitely seeing that sometimes when I go out. There are not enough people on the floor for how many people come in.
Well, not enough people as there has been in the flush times.
Correct.
And I think our expectations of dining and what service we should expect to receive have changed. I think a lot of restaurants are recalibrating. Look, in New Jersey, and I think in New York, waiters make a minimum wage less a tip credit. It costs me $2 an hour to put a waiter on the floor.
Right.
However, the waiters are in a tip pool, or even when they're not in a pool house, the waiters are sharing their tips with each other and with, the bartender and the back waiter and the service bartender.
As the owner or the manager of that restaurant or place, it costs very little to put another waiter on the floor.
Yeah, there's no incentive for me to cut wait staff.
That's not no incentive. But the incentive is not a financial for, is the business making enough money? That's not the incentive to cut wait staff. Like it is in the kitchen. If your food's not coming out fast enough, if there's issues with quality, those may be cost-cutting issues.
Sure. If I cut a line cook, I don't have to pay that line cook's salary that night. Mm-hmm. If I remove a sous chef, I don't have to pay the sous chef's salary that night. That would be where a restaurant would cut, not in the front of the house.
But in front of the house, the issue there is waiters may not be making enough money.
Right.
Okay. But I don't pay the waiter. The customer
you
does.
Pay the waiter.
You pay the waiter. And I think what Francis was starting to talk about there is, as people are spending less in restaurants, there are fewer waiters on the floor because the waiters are making less money, and the waiters still need to make at least a percentage of what they were making before in order to maintain their bills and be content in their jobs.
Well, and that may come in a lot of ways. You may be in a restaurant at a busy moment in New York City, but look, New York City is designed, the restaurants in New York City are designed to be busy for an extended period of service time. Out here in the burbs in Jersey, we're not open till 3 in the morning. In Kansas, they're not open past 8 o'clock. I know I'm going to get some hate email from Kansas, but I apologize in advance. But so if you have a certain number of waiters on the floor, and the people in the dining room aren't spending as much. And there have been some indications that some people are tipping a lower percentage. That we haven't seen that in our restaurants at all.
Mm-hmm.
So people aren't spending as much. They're not buying the bottles of wine they were buying. They're not tipping as much is what we hear. And they're going out less frequently. So even if it's busy at that moment, the shift is less busy because the hours are not quite as long. Mm-hmm. That's less money that goes in a tip pool. You can't get a waiter to come to work if it's $50 that they make at the end
Correct.
Of the night. It's just it's not doable for the waiter. It's not worth pressing his clothes and taking the train to work.
I also want to add another theory to this equation here. And the theory is that I have, this is a personal theory of mine, that something that kind of went unnoticed by most diners is that in a lot of restaurants, the majority of diners and the service experience they were getting was being subsidized by the big hitter, by the person who was spending a lot of money. Okay? If everybody in the dining room came in and ordered a $35 or $40 bottle of wine, well, there's not really enough money in the tip pool to pay a sommelier to be tableside to recommend wines. But if some of the people are ordering $45 bottles of wine and some of the people are ordering $400 bottles of wine, well, now there's a sommelier around to take care of everyone.
Right.
Because the $400 person doesn't need you to be there every minute of the day. So your sommelier, who's being subsidized by the $400 bottle of wine, has time to talk to the $45 bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is no $400 bottle of wine being sold, then perhaps there's no sommelier on the floor.
And another thing that's happened with restaurants overall is, and everyone is experiencing this, things are less predictable than they've ever been.
That is a huge factor that has to be played into this. Because even an established 17-year-old restaurant like mine and Francis's, there are certain nights where we're expecting a relatively slow night, and there was a relatively slow night the night before, and nothing's really changed.
And you'll get a busy hit.
And now all of a sudden you're busy. And like Francis was talking about before, maybe the night isn't even that busy. It's just 45 minutes of being busy.
Well, and your reservation book is less of a predictor, as mm-hmm. the restaurant is less likely to be consistently booked up, so you know where your business is. And you know another thing that restaurants do? When restaurants are really busy and really booked up, they will space their reservations
mm-hmm.
so that a certain number of tables come in at 6, a certain number come in at 6:15, a certain number come in at 6:30, and if you call and say, oh, I want to come in at 7, and there are too many people coming in at 7, they'll push you to 7:15 or 6:45. And they do that so that they're sure the staff on
hand
can get to everyone's needs, and not everyone's sitting at the same moment, needing a menu at the same moment, needing to hear the specials at the same moment. Well, you know what? If it's fairly slow, and look, diners are more demanding now. They come. They say, I'd like to come in for dinner at 7 o'clock. And if you say, can you come at 6:45, they're more likely to say, no, I'll go someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want my business? And so what restaurants are more likely to do is say, okay, whenever you want to come, it's fine.
Right.
But that leads to a less predictable flow of business. And the other thing that's happened is we know in both business and personal reservations, people are making last-minute reservations or coming
much
with
more
no reservations much more frequently.
Much more frequently than ever in the past. And one of the reasons that people are doing that is they know that most restaurants, except at the busy times, are not going to be completely booked. So if it's Tuesday night, you want to come for an early reservation or a late reservation, you don't have to really make a reservation at most New Jersey restaurants.
And in many in New York.
And
anyway,
in
so,
many in New York.
You know, I don't think this is – we're not making an excuse for the restaurant business. We're just – I think that Bruni raised here an interesting conjecture as to why.
Yeah, and I disagree as to why it's happening.
Oh, I'm certain that his conjecture is not right.
I'm certain that it's happening, though. I think he's observing a real phenomenon.
Sure.
I think there are less servers on the floor than there were, and – whether it's one of the two or three reasons that Francis and I stated or another one, I don't think it's what Bruni said.
But, you know, it's interesting times in which we live, and restaurants are recalibrating and figuring out new ways, and the good ones are figuring out new ways to satisfy their customers' needs, your needs. And that's the struggle every day, man. Struggle every day.
It is.
Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Returning to our show is Mark Kurlansky. He is the best-selling author of several books, Cod, Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, Salt, The Big Oyster, History on a Half Shell, and his current book is just as wonderful. It's The Food of a Younger Land.
Mark, welcome to the show.
Always nice to talk to you.
You may not know this, but you're a pretty good writer.
Oh, well, thank you.
Now, The Food of a Younger Land is based on an unfinished project of the Work Projects Administration, right, where it was a documentary of what happened or what was the status of American cuisine, which was kind of...
It's the Federal Writers Project, a branch of the WPA, had this idea of documenting America. It was a very 30s idea, an idea in the Depression, that it was time to take a look at the country. And this woman, Catherine Kellogg, who was running the Federal Writers Project, she was an administrator, noticed that there were no guidebooks to America. The only guidebook to America was a 1909 Baedeker that had been written by a Brit. And so she started this project of writing guidebooks. And they wrote guidebooks to all 48 states and most major cities and some minor cities. And important literary critics gave rave reviews to these books. Some of them were bestsellers. Some of them are still in print and enjoyed today. But they had done a guide to just about everywhere and what to do next. And Catherine Kellogg came up with this idea that they ought to do a book on what Americans eat, the kinds of food they eat, the kind of food traditions, the kind of eating traditions, the kind of gatherings and social conflicts and everything about food in America. It was going to be called America Eats. And they sent out, there were about 6,000 people in the Federal Writers Project organized state by state. And the thing was that to be in the Federal Writers Project, you didn't have to have any credentials as a writer. The main qualification is that you had to show that you were broke. And some of the people were really writers. There were some notable figures from the Harlem Renaissance, like Claude McKay and Zora Neale Hurston. And there were quite a number of people who went on to do great things, like Nelson Algren and Ralph Ellison and Richard Wright and Saul Bellow, John Cheever, Kenneth Rexroth, the beat poet, which I think that really shows how amazing this whole thing was.
Heavens to Betsy.
Kenneth Rexroth ran the San Francisco Federal Writers Project, and just the idea of having a beat poet running a government agency explains a lot. And so they were all going to gather as much information as they could about food, and they were going to give them to five designated writers who were going to write 100-word essays about the five regions they had broken the country up into. Nelson Algren was going to write the Midwestern one, and they had somebody for each section. Then on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and December 8th and December 9th, Catherine Kellogg sent out these letters. I know this because it's all in the archives in the Library of Congress. Sent out these frantic letters saying, you know, whatever you have on America Eats, send it in now and we'll try to publish something before we're closed down. Because they knew World War II was coming and it was going to be the end of the whole New Deal. And so people just sent in whatever they had, completely unedited. And then they were closed down, and she took all this stuff and dumped it in boxes in the Library of Congress. And there it has sat ever since. And
so how did you get a hold of it?
Well, I went to the Library of Congress and opened the boxes. And, you know, most of this material is stuff that was never intended for publication. It was just intended to inform the people who were writing the regional essays. And it was everything, you know. It was recipes, and it was lists of dishes, and it was descriptions of food traditions and descriptions of gatherings and short stories and poems and just a bit of everything. And a lot of it was, as I say, things that, you know, they had no intention of ever seeing published, certainly not in the form it was submitted.
And as it, as you point out in the book, this was a unique precipice of American food, because after World War II, with the development of the interstate highway system and sort of the retreating of the local food shed as a major source of our
food.
Yeah,
and the industrialization of agriculture. And
yeah, so this was the last moment before the beginning of the industrialization of agriculture, right?
Yes, yeah. And when I was going through these boxes, I had this sense, you know, it was like one of those children's stories that I'd, you know, somehow fallen through a hole and ended up in 1940 America, which was a very different country. And even the manuscript, you know, they were that old onion skin paper and they were carbon copies. And you see this very different country, a country that had a very strong cuisine and a very strong sense of its own cuisine. And, you know, much like the way today you can still travel in France or Italy or Spain or China and go from region to region and experience completely different food. America used to be like that. It changed not only from region to region, sometimes from county to county.
You mean the McDonald's in one state would be different than the McDonald's in another state?
Well, you know, a lot of the development of fast food had to do with the development of highways, which was in the 1960s. So, you know, it was very much a world of, you know, what we call home cooking.
Well, and you talk about in your book how at this time there were no highways, there was no fast food, and there were very few freezers, and the ones they had didn't work very well.
That's right.
But
they didn't hold much, and they didn't work well.
And the big changes that were made was instead of driving through all these tiny little towns where you would sample all this regional cuisine as you stopped from place to place, because that's where the roads went through, you were on a superhighway, and some
and
kind
fast
of fast food place would pop up.
It was
up.
The same everywhere.
Yeah.
It changed everything. The kind of food that is in this book still exists in America, but the difference is that in 1940, this is what you found everywhere you went. Today, you have to be a detective to find this stuff.
Now, back in this time, was there a strong national cuisine, or were there things that were national in scope, or was it really much more of a regional cuisine? Would people from the Northeast eat entirely differently from people in the South?
Correct, yes. There were completely different cuisines than, you know, northern New England and southern New England, and the food in Mississippi was not the food in Virginia, and
so talk to us about some of the things that may have fallen out of the American diet that would be indicative of a certain region or were important to a certain region in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, as I say, these things haven't completely disappeared, but they're hard to find. There's still Johnny Cakes in Rhode Island, if you're lucky enough to find them. And they still make Brunswick stew in Virginia, although I have run into numerous people who have had Brunswick stew, but all of them said there wasn't any squirrel in it. There was supposed to be squirrel in Brunswick stew. And just, you know, regional traditions that have sort of gotten buried underground.
Buried underground and trying to be brought back, though, by hardcore food enthusiasts, and I think that's something
that's
that people
right.
are open
and,
to embrace.
And, not so much the dishes. I mean, the dishes also, but, you know, the idea of getting your food from local artisanal farms, which is very much a movement today. In the 1930s, it wasn't a movement. It was just a way of life. And there was, you know, the good things about it and the bad things about it. Bad things about it is that a lot of things weren't available.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to spend September and October putting up food to have stuff to eat through. Right. Till April.
We do it all the time. It's not so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun. It's interesting. The food's really good.
Right. And you notice it in these recipes, they call for a lot of canned food, which is sort of surprising today. But, you know, that was very much part of the tradition of food. And
would that be commercially canned food or home canned food?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, it would be home. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't specify in most of these recipes.
Well, when we come back in just a moment, we're going to talk with Mark Kurlansky about the food of a younger land, a little road trip through 1930s America to see it was a very fortunate snapshot of American cuisine. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Mark Kurlansky. His current book, The Food of a Younger Land, A Portrait of American Food Before the National Highway System, Before Chain Restaurants, Before Frozen Food, When the Nation's Food Was Seasonal, Regional, and Tradition, and titles were very, very long. Hello, Mark. Now, Mark, what were some of the most interesting foods that you came across in this survey?
Well, one of the things I found interesting is that there were a lot of recipes for, it was during the Depression, and for making do with very few ingredients. So there was something called the Depression Cake, which was kind of a nice story about this woman. It was 4th of July was coming up, and she was expected to bake a cake, and she didn't have any eggs, and she didn't have any butter. And she just took flour and baking soda and a bunch of spices and bacon fat and mixed it all up, put it in the oven. And to her amazement, it came out the cake. And I've tried this recipe, and it's a great cake, proving that, you know, anything's good if you use bacon.
it is a magic ingredient. I believe that.
I know that I'm a little bit of a food geek. I know that it's true, but I have to say that the sections of just cuisine that's gone, the sections of culture that's completely gone are the ones that I found the most fascinating. You know, rarely do we see Sioux and Chippewa jerking buffalo anymore. And
yes.
To me, that was just amazing and resourceful, and they're creating products that could last for years and years. That's just a remarkable adaptation to life.
I skipped that section. How long can jerking buffalo last, Mark?
3 to 4 years, according to Francis Densmore.
Really?
Who was actually a noted anthropologist she was an expert on the Chippewa.
Well, if you'd like to try some nifty stuff, I think that maybe the jerking buffalo should be held for the more advanced of our listeners. You should check out Mark Kurlansky's new book, like you should check out all of his books. It's called The Food of a Younger Land. Mark, thanks for being on the show.
A wonderful slice through time, Mark.
Thank you. Always nice talking to you guys.
Likewise. Now, you can pick up information on that book at RestaurantGuysRadio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
One of the very, very many interesting points of Kurlansky's book here is he does a little segment on the vernacular, the words of the day.
The luncheonette vernacular, the short order cook sort of vernacular.
Exactly, where they had different words for some of the things that you think of today, and Francis has a couple examples there, but soup was called belly wash, and butter was called axle grease.
You know, a glass of milk was called a baby. That one seems really cute to me. Also called cow juice, also called for some reason a Jersey cocktail. Don't get that one.
Jersey cows, silly.
Oh, look at
that.
Not I'm
New Jersey.
New Jersey, yeah.
That's funny. You know what?
But my favorite is the numbers. My favorite is the numbers. You know, because many of you have heard the expression 86. If something's 86, it means there is no more. I don't know where that came from. I've heard a lot of stories.
None of which I'm sure are correct.
But there are a bunch of numbers here. I didn't know there were numbers. A 95 is a customer who leaves without paying. Not very popular in the 95s. A 49 meant look at the beautiful girl. A 14 is listed as C49. And a 14 and a half is a beautiful girl, a little on the plump side.
That's funny. It's a far cry from the Ripper and a Howdy at Rutt's Hut.
Rutt's Hut, great hot dog place in North Jersey. Where
I'm looking forward to my next Ripper.
Just so you know, Rippers and a Howdy is how they order in their short order jargon. A fried hot dog in which the skin rips is a Ripper, and a Howdy would be an orange soda.
Howdy Doody.
And I often go to, when I'm at Rutt's Hut, I order two Rippers and a Howdy. I order two hot dogs and an orange soda because I want to hear the guy say, two Rippers and a Howdy.
And remember the golden rule.
Wait, but I don't like orange soda. I just want to hear him say it.
And remember the golden rule.
Yeah.
If a hot dog costs more than a hamburger, don't order the hamburger.
That's a very good rule. Oh, and Rutt's Hut has a liquor license. You can go around back and get a beer. That's it. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are The Restaurant Guys at WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.